Welcome to the Institute. We're really pleased to see you here today. The subject of ethnic conflict and ethnic violence in all of its forms has preoccupied the community of which the Institute is a part, as well as the Institute itself, and for many, many years. I was trying to get a handle on how the Institute has dealt with this subject, and I looked back over the 16 years in which the Institute has been making grants, trying to get a sense of how many were on the subject of ethnic conflict, ethnic violence. And we categorize our applications and our grants by 22 different subject categories, one of which is ethnic conflict, which we use the classic social science definition to include religious violence in that definition. And over this 16-year period, we've run broad unsolicited grant competitions in which we invite proposals on any subject related to the Institute's mandate. And so what we receive in the way of applications, I think, reflects what the broader community is thinking about, both the practitioner and the social science community. And I think what's interesting about this is if you look back over these 16 years, by far and away, the subject of ethnic conflict has dominated our grant making. It is we've made nearly twice as many grants on this subject as the next subject category in our list of 22 categories. And nearly all of the Institute's in-house programs, including our new special initiative on the Muslim world, at one time or another have focused on the subject of ethnic violence, ethnic conflict, and have addressed two basic questions. First of all, what factors are responsible for the outbreak of violent ethnic conflict around the world? And secondly, how can ethnic violence be prevented? In other words, what positive steps can be taken at the local, national, and international levels by individuals, members of communities, and policymakers to curb or prevent the outbreak of violent conflict between ethnic groups? Now, scholars and practitioners over the years have attempted to discern patterns in the outbreak of ethnic violence around the world and have asserted various propositions. Among the arguments put forward by scholars and practitioners over the years are the following. First of all, that ethnic identities are primordial and immutable, and that age-old animosities between and among groups inevitably give rise to violence. Other people have argued that ethnic violence occurs because political elites manipulate ethnic identities for their own nefarious purposes to gain and retain political and economic power and resources, and that ethnic violence is most likely to break out in places where there's authoritative political support for group violence. Others have argued that ethnic violence is most likely to occur in places where institutional arrangements and political systems prevent adequate representation of minority group interests. And others have argued that violent ethnic conflict is most likely to rise in places where civil society is weak and where ties between neighbors are weak. Others have argued that it's a combination of all of these factors. Our speakers today are among the best-known scholars who have helped us make sense of these questions, and the two of them have left very large footprints in the field. I'm really proud to say that the Institute has funded the work that they are both presenting today through grants in both cases. And in both cases, these grants have resulted in books. And there are flyers outside on the outside table for anyone who's interested in purchasing these books. There's also a copy of both books in our library. Professor Donald L. Horowitz will speak first and will help set the scene for us. His book, The Deadly Ethnic Riot, draws upon data from some 50 countries and provides comparative analysis of the structure and forms, the morphology, if you will, of ethnic riots around the world. Professor Horowitz is the James B. Duke Professor of Law and Political Science at Duke University, and he's the author of 6 books and has edited several others. He's also the author of dozens of articles on subjects ranging from the legal process, ethnic politics, and military coups. He's received too many awards and fellowships to mention here, but they include an award from the National Academy of Public Administration for his book, The Courts and Social Policy. He received the Outstanding Academic Book Award from Choice Magazine for his book, Ethnic Groups in Conflict. And in 1993, he was elected a fellow of the Academy, American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He also received the Ralph Bunche Award for his from APSA for his book called A Democratic South Africa? Our second speaker, Professor Asutosh Varshney, will focus our attention more narrowly on where and why ethnic violence occurs and does not occur among Hindus and Muslims in India, which is the focus of his book. But he also will present comparisons to other parts of Asia and beyond. Professor Varshney is the Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the Center for South Asian Studies at the University of Michigan. He has published three books and numerous papers and articles in such journals as Comparative Politics, World Politics, the Journal of Democracy, Journal of Asian Studies. He's received numerous grants and fellowships from such institutions as the SSRC, Ford Foundation, Woodrow Wilson Center, the Rajiv Gandhi Foundation. And he's served as a consultant to a variety of different organizations, both private and governmental. His recently published USIP-funded book is called Ethnic Conflict in Civic Life, Hindus and Muslims in India, and it received a great deal of attention from the press when it appeared earlier this year, among others the New York Times, the National Public Radio, because his timing was impeccable. It appeared around the time that there was an outbreak of a renewal of violent Hindu-Muslim riots in India this summer. So welcome to all of you, and Professor Hurwitz.
Thank you very much. Judy was kind enough to mention that I have been the recipient of USIP's largesse. What she was especially kind not to mention was that it takes me years to deliver on the projects that USIP funds, and I just want to take this opportunity publicly to assure her that my current grant will be completed on or before the day of her retirement. Which I take it is about 40 years away.
It's worth the wait.
The reason it takes so long is that these are big projects. The book I want to talk about today, which Judy has mentioned, The Deadly Ethnic Riot, deals with 150 episodes of ethnic violence, which I'll define in just a minute. In about 50 countries, and also 50 control cases, that is to say near misses, which can be used as negative cases to help explain and verify whether the assertions about causation in the 150 are correct. Let me begin by, I've only got two transparencies, so I shan't march back and forth here very many times, but let me put the first one on.
Just nice. Suspect.
We might.
As no theory is perfect, neither is any transparency. The deadly ethnic riot, and I want to insist on a definition here because there are so many different kinds of violence that one might conflate with what I want to talk about that I want to specify precisely what it is I want to talk about. The deadly ethnic riot is an intense, sudden, though not necessarily wholly unplanned, lethal attack by civilian members of one ethnic group on civilian members of another, the victims chosen because of their group membership. These are truly vicious events. They involve not merely killing and maiming, but they involve the infliction of atrocities, mutilations, really not just death, but horrific death. They produce large numbers of deaths, large numbers of refugees, usually a number much in excess of the number of deaths, and they typically produce after the event much greater homogeneity of the area in which the violence has occurred than was the case before the episode. If you're looking for examples, they are abundant, although not universal, as Ashu will point out. These are commonplace events, but they don't occur everywhere and every time. Hindu-Muslim riots are obvious examples. The Sri Lanka riots of 1983 that really kicked off the Tamil Tigers insurrection, the Kuala Lumpur riots of 1969, the Nigerian anti-Igbo riots of 1966, which eventually precipitated the Biafra War. More recently in Indonesia, riots in West Kalimantan against Madaris, in Maluku, in the so-called Spice Islands, between Christians and Muslims. But one could cite many, many more. And if you have a favorite riot, you want to talk about it. If I know something about it, why, we can talk about it. For about 50 years, theories have been advanced periodically to try and explain events of this kind. And over the last 40 years or so, the theories have overwhelmingly been concerned with grievance, with relative deprivation, or the actions of malevolent politicians who are inciting people, or the actions of people who have something to gain from the killing, something palpable to gain and something rational to gain. What's been underemphasized for the last several decades is the role of passion and the agency of members of crowds. There is so much violence and so much overheated violence in one of these episodes that it's very difficult to believe that it's merely manipulated, that it's something like a bank robbery. It's not that. These are crowd activities, and one might take the title of this event to be something like taking crowds seriously, because I think crowds and the way in which they behave have been underestimated. Several aspects of the deadly ethnic riot require a return to the crowd. Let me say it more precisely. The scale of the riot, the explosiveness of the riot, and its seemingly disproportionate character, that is, disproportionate to the events that tend to precipitate it. Second, its brutality and gore, which I already mentioned. Third, its ability to attract participants in spite of the apparent benefits of free riding. You may hate the other people, but why go out and kill the other people when you can sit back and let others do the work for you? In fact, there's quite a lot of voluntary and authentic participation in these riots. And fourth, the mix of impulsive and instrumental elements. To emphasize crowd behavior and passion is not to rule out the presence of instrumental behavior intermingled with it. And that's what I want to emphasize most, the interesting mix of passion and calculation that pervades these events. So let me take the rest of my time doing essentially two things. First, I want to highlight a couple of characteristics of deadly ethnic riots that have been underemphasized, and then I want to unpack some elements of a causal explanation. With respect to the first task, I would emphasize two themes. The first is the theme of lucid madness. The deadly ethnic riot is characterized by sadism and euphoria and bestial slaughter, but also by elements of prudence and foresight. There's an orgy of killing, but it's punctuated by interludes of detached planning. Traps are laid for victims who, when discovered, are then murdered brutally. There's great precision in targeting. Group A wants to attack members, or members of Group A want to attack members of Group B, but not members of Groups C, D, E, or the aggressive Group A. And it conducts its investigations of prospective victims meticulously to make sure that mistakes are not made. There's a great aversion to false positives. If there's a doubt about the identity of a putative member of Group B that's the target, there's a good chance that person, if it can't be verified that the person is a member of Group B, that person will be sent on his way. Talk about why that is, but it's true. The crowds choose relatively safe locations, and they tend to go to other locations if it's unsafe. These are the elements of prudence. So heights of disinhibition are coupled with the most careful calculation. That's the first of the two themes I would like to emphasize. And the second is that the pervasive emotions that are present in these events are anxiety and hatred. And you can't get them out by any kind of rationalist analysis. You can't convert anxiety to reasonable and proportionate fear, for example. There's a great deal of faulty reasoning that the crowd engages in, and a great deal of magnification of the danger that the group the crowd represents faces. So before the event, there are rumors of aggression, false, projective rumors. In fact, they're rumors of events that haven't occurred, or at least haven't occurred in the form the rumor depicts them as having occurred, and they also are just exactly the sort of event that's about to be undertaken by members of the crowd itself. I can tell you some of the ghastly details if you like, but I think I'll spare you them, except on request. There are rumors, for example, there were rumors in Sri Lanka in one riot that a Tamil army was on its way to invade the south. No such army was on its way. In northern Nigeria, there was a rumor in almost exactly the same terms that an Igbo army was on its way to the north. No such army was on its way. Although, by the way, the action of the crowd helped in each case to produce the creation of a Tamil army, the LTTE eventually, and an Igbo army, the army that fought for the independence of Biafra. There's a mix of hypervigilance and circumspection in these riots. The rioters imagine themselves to be engaged in a heroic act of self-defense. Armies on the march. Sometimes the rumor is, and very commonly the rumor is, the water supply has been poisoned. Well, that's really a life or death issue. If the water supply has been poisoned, you've got to take the most drastic action. The rioters overestimate the danger. They misperceive what their enemies are up to. Yes, their enemies are threatening, it's true, but the imminence of the threat is not as the rioters imagine it. That's the anxiety side. Let me mention the hatred side. This is angry violence, and it is pleasurable violence. It's a whole lot of fun for those who engage in it. And it's violence that springs from hatred of the targets. That's why it always aims at degradation, destruction, and homogenization. It has a kind of proto-genocidal aspect to it. Drive out the Bengalis, is what they said in Assam. All Madhuris must leave, is what they said in Kalimantan. Burn, don't loot, is what they say in many places. This, I think, is in most ways the most revealing of the slogans. Burn, don't loot. That is to say, destroy. Don't profit from it. You don't need to profit from it. Destroy them. And so, what I hope I've demonstrated in this few minutes is that there is a mix of rational and impulsive behavior, and therefore a challenge to the usual explanatory paradigms, which are directed either at one or at the other. And now let me take a crack at an explanatory paradigm of my own. What I want to suggest is that the concatenation of four conditions best explains the deadly ethnic riot. First, a hostile relationship between two ethnic groups. Not necessarily, by the way, a traditionally hostile one. Not one of these ancient enmities that President Clinton was so keen on in the Balkans. Second, a response to events that engages the emotions of one of these collectivities, a response usually denominated as anger, but perhaps more accurately rendered as arousal, rage, outrage, or wrath. Third, a keenly felt sense of justification for killing. And fourth, an assessment of the reduced risks of violence that facilitates disinhibition. The riot is underpinned by hostility directed against targets who are believed to possess certain threatening characteristics. Arousal is produced by an occasion deemed suitable for violence, believed to present one or more of a limited class of threats in intergroup relations. The riot is event-driven. Something happens that produces the riot. Justification is a function of beliefs about the propriety of violence against ethnic strangers and about the transgressive conduct of those strangers. And reduced inhibitions are produced by environmental conditions that affect the rioters' calculations of risk. These components, which I want to unpack in inverse order, conjoin to produce the violent episode. So let me proceed with the unpacking. Risk reduction that facilitates disinhibition, that allows people to do things they would otherwise be inhibited from doing. A major theme of the violent enterprise is risk reduction. Angry or aroused people are not necessarily heedless of risk. And an impressively wide range of conditions affects the rioters' calculations of risk. Among these are supernatural beliefs in invulnerability. There are various invulnerability rituals that some members of some crowds go through first. Lack of credible opposing force or possible retaliation from the victims or their representatives, or from the police for that matter. Societal condonation, confirmed by the action and inaction of the state. Inadequate police deployment, and a variety of risk-averting tactical decisions taken by the rioters themselves. Take a look at the elements that reduce risk. The creation of overwhelming mass, rioters attacking crowds. The use of usually bladed weapons against unarmed civilians, and the leadership of local figures who are skilled in fighting. All of these provide a great initial advantage for the aggressors. After all, small unarmed crowds do not usually kill large numbers of victims. And then there is selective targeting. Remember, A kills members of Group A kill members of Group B, but not C, D, and E. Selective targeting derives from other sources. In fact, it really goes back to the choice of targets, goes back to the antecedent conflict. But it also operates to reduce the prospect that multiple opponents will combine against the attackers. The care with which rioters go about choosing victims is also designed to avert the possibility that the attackers will accidentally kill a member of their own group, because that kind of killing would, among other things, reduce intra-group support for the violence. Crowds also stay close to home. They don't commute far to do this work. They attack in locales where they have a tactical advantage, and they retreat or relocate the attack when they encounter unexpected resistance. They choose moments when their targets are unprotected by the police and by social and political authorities, when they have little fear of retaliation or criminal punishment, and when compunctions about killing are inoperative. They attack strong targets at weak moments. They don't attack vulnerable, weak third parties. Forget about the notion of scapegoats. And furthermore, they judge risk accurately, and you can tell by looking at the lopsided casualty count. I don't know of any case in which more rioters were killed than targets. This is a low-risk enterprise, and therefore there is hope for deterrence by increasing risk. If you want to think about policies, think in terms of risk. There are other ways into this problem, too, but that's one way. Second, justification. The riot conceived as rightful violence, because it certainly is conceived that way. There are common motifs of justification, and there's a cognitive mechanism that rioters invoke. Justification is based on the enormity of the danger the rioters think they face. They think they're repelling mass aggression from the target group. Remember, armies on the march. And you know that they're thinking in these terms because often pre-riot rituals involve traditional martial practices on the part of the riot, members of the rioting crowd. They are thinking in terms of military operations. And of course, killing in warfare is permissible. Likewise, retribution, that is, punishing transgressors when government has failed to take appropriate action, is also regarded as permissible. However different they are in other respects, the common core of self-defense, warfare, and punishment for wrongdoing is that each killing is not considered singly, but as part of an extended transaction in which victims and perpetrators change places. They are killing us, therefore we may kill them. It's one transaction. It's not two. The riot didn't start the moment we started to kill them. It started before that. The person who kills under these circumstances is relieved of responsibility for the killing by virtue of the connection established between that killing and the conduct that precedes it. As I said, rioters don't think they're attacking, they think they're responding. Consider the fact that rumors of aggression are just about universal in the events that precede the riot. The killing is not subject to moral judgment apart from the entire sequence of events. That's not my view, that's their view. Arousal. The deadly ethnic riot, as I said, is angry violence, and that explains its magnitude, its explosive character, its ability to attract participants. Anger always opens the possibility of action greater than its cause. It always opens the possibility of disproportion. It doesn't take more than a little personal experience to verify that proposition. Anger, as Aristotle pointed out, derives from fear. And precipitating events impart proximity to those fears. The targets of antipathy are uniformly seen to be dangerous groups. The precipitating event confirms the hostile intentions of the targets, and it demonstrates what the rioters think is great cohesion among members of the target group. That is to say, the rioters don't distinguish a precipitant that comes from a fraction of a target group from a precipitant that is representative of the activities and intentions and proclivities of members of the target group. The precipitant evokes a strong sense of danger. These are not random shocks. And on the whole, riots tend not to arise out of private quarrels or personal affronts either. Still on the question of arousal, aggression is satisfying. We have many studies of the cathartic effect of aggression. Those who aggress feel better afterwards, no question about it. And satisfaction accounts for the participation of the rioters in events like this. Killing and degrading are the objectives, and these cannot be enjoyed vicariously by free riders. They are consummatory satisfactions. There are atrocities and mutilations, as I mentioned. The crowd doesn't calibrate the quantum of its violence. The pleasure is in the doing and in the overdoing, rather than in sending a message. And as a matter of fact, often the crowd trades off the quality of the killing, that is to say, the infliction of atrocities, against the magnitude of the killing. One can efficiently kill a lot more people if you don't want to do it through torture and atrocities. This is violence that is in many ways appropriately labeled recreational, and it bears some relationship to studies of violent street criminals, which suggest rather the same thing. So we get a surfeit of violence. It's explosive, it's disproportionate. And to explain this, you need to understand that anger can grow over time, and it can be stored and redirected. We have a number of experiments that show that this is the case. The memory of prior aversive events can be tapped by a current event to enhance the level of anger. People connect today's provocation to yesterday's, and they report experiencing continued hostility and lasting grievances from earlier incidents. And then they are able to express all the accumulated anger at once. Let me assure you that in severely divided societies, there is plenty of accumulated anger, and the riot is one gateway for its release. The precipitants are evocative of the whole course of relations, and they trigger associated memories and draw out stored anger. And finally, under anger, the sociology of the riot situation. When conventional norms are inoperative, sadists, bullies, and fighters become models for emulation and respect in ways that they are not in ordinary times. And peer pressure in a crowd means that a little violence is likely to grow into a lot of violence. Some of you may have seen at some point the wonderful study of baiting crowds and suicides. It's a study done entirely from newspaper accounts, an absolutely fascinating study. A person threatens to jump off a bridge, let us say. A crowd gathers around that person. The crowd is more likely to urge the person to jump, in other words, to take advantage of the person's plight and to hope for the worst, the larger it is. The study is quite clear on this. The larger the crowd, the more likely the brutality of the crowd, even though in this case the agent of the brutality is the victim himself. Finally, antipathy. A necessary condition for the deadly ethnic riot, but an emotion almost unknown to social science. We have, from decades past, studies of prejudice, studies of the correlates of prejudice and occasionally the roots of prejudice, practically no studies of the character of antipathy, of hatred. Experiments show that anger is easier to evoke when there is prior hostility toward the targets, and it produces a more severe response than when there is not. By antipathy, I mean strong opposition, antagonism, or aversion. This is a durable emotion, and it's therefore available for invocation as events arise. Ethnic antipathy takes anger-producing events and converts them into acts of an entire group, not just of individuals. Antipathy produces a tendency toward generalization and away from the individuation of targets. You focus your anger on the whole group, so that antipathy, ethnic antipathy now, makes violence indiscriminately ethnic. And you'll notice that while I said earlier that members of Group A target members of Group B, but not members of Groups C, D, and E, within the target Group B, the violence is indiscriminate. The crowd doesn't care whether the person, the member of Group B it encounters on the street, is a good person or a bad person. It doesn't care whether this person likes or dislikes members of Group B. The crowd is indiscriminate with respect to members of Group B, as indiscriminate as it is discriminate with respect to members of Groups B, C, D, and E. Antipathy also contributes to the brutality and magnitude of the violence, because to see events through the lens of antipathy is to magnify them. And if antipathy shades over into hatred, then there will be more magnification of evil intentions. An understanding of hatred that most understudied of emotions facilitates the understanding of indiscriminate violence against members of the target group. So let me take a quick crack at ethnic hatred. Ethnic hatred consists of at least four elements. First, a growing and even obsessive focus on the hated group to the neglect of others. Second, a belief that the hated group possesses fixed characteristics and dispositions to action. In a certain sense, there's an empathy for the hated group. It can't help itself. That's its nature. It just has to behave that way. Third, a compression of intra-group differences attributed to members of the hated group. And fourth, an active sense of repulsion toward the group and its members. There may be other aspects of hatred as well, but I think these four are more or less irreducible. The brutality of the deadly ethnic riot responds not merely to proximate events, but to fundamental character traits as the rioters see them, and the behavior that can be expected of the targets. Group antipathy never permits consideration of a precipitant as a one-time event. It always means something else. So as ontologists, as people who order their world as they encounter it, rioters show themselves to be prodigious unifiers. They assiduously link events together in a single unbounded chain. That is, they don't distinguish between their violence and the violence they think they're responding to. And they also link the targets in an indivisible group, not distinguishing among them within the target group. They don't reason the way social scientists habitually do, partitioning variables, which is one reason why social science has had so much trouble understanding them. Thank you very much.